Many of you know that last fall we spent a number of weeks after church in a small discussion group on the Pope's encyclical Laudato Si, on care for our common home. What a strange text for today. It doesn't sound like a very Thanksgiving Day or a Valentine's Day text, does it, from Jeremiah 12:4 printed in your bulletin. How long will the land mourn and the grass of every field wither? The carelessness of those who live in it, the animals and the birds, are swept away because people said, God is blind to our ways. I was thinking through this service, and I thought, well, there's a lot of things going on. It happens to be Valentine's Day. It's the first Sunday of Lent, and it also happens to be the day of the national preach-in on climate justice from Interfaith Power and Light, and I thought, I want to give people a challenge. If they had to preach a sermon interweaving all of those themes, what would you come up with? It was hard. There's a lot to think about. But really, those themes are kind of interrelated in some interesting, though maybe perhaps strange ways. And so the sermon title that I have printed here in the bulletin is The Gift of Struggle, Choosing a Better Way. And we're talking through the whole season of Lent on gifts of the dark wood, that is, the gifts that come to us in the midst of our difficulties. Very often we try to get out of our difficulties so that we can have that better life. And sometimes the better life comes to us by being in our difficulties and finding the gift that is there. And so today we're thinking about the gift of struggle because we are in difficulties when it comes to our earth home. This is a church that has long been concerned with climate justice and green justice. As many of you know, last year we divested the invested assets that we have from fossil fuel holdings. We're part of Interfaith Power and Light, which is a group that helps local churches come together to educate folks about climate and green justice issues, and also to do advocacy at the state level. We've been active in doing some of that advocacy right here in Granville. Last fall, we showed a film called Merchants of Doubt, which you can see on, I don't know if it's Vimeo or YouTube, but you can go online and find it. It's very worth your watch, much worth your watch. And then this spring, of course, we're having a special discussion after the services, and Jill referred to that, on climate solutions and ways to think about how these green justice issues interrelate and dovetail with so many of the other justice issues that we face today. There's a handout attached to your bulletin today also, which offers some data about climate change and climate justice, and it's the same handout we used last year in 2014. I asked our green justice chair about this. I said, do you have some updated figures? And he said, unfortunately, everything on this sheet is still the same. If we change the date from 2014 where it says it's official, 2014 was the hottest year globally in recorded history. If we change that date to 2015, it would still be true. 2015 was the hottest year in recorded human history. So this is a nice synopsis that you can give to others who are trying to think through this issue, particularly from a faith-based perspective. We also have been aware of the Paris talks last year that have gone on. And there was progress made at the Paris talks in terms of reducing emissions to improve our climate situation and the breathing system of our planet. But I invite you to think a little bit more about this issue today from a stance that we don't usually look at it from, and that is a stance that we as faith communities can particularly bring to the discussion. It's something that we in our faith traditions are specifically equipped to offer, and that's a holistic take on this question of climate justice and climate change. And the Pope's reading, the reading from Pope Francis' encyclical that Pat did, sort of touches on this in a way. The take that we as faith communities can offer is one that backs away from the technical question about how to solve the problem of the heating up of our planet and asks more fundamental questions. So I'm going to encourage you to think about those today and to try to lighten up what can be a very heavy a topic, I thought I'd use this illustration that I used last year on Climate Justice Sunday. Let's think about a house. Think about a house that you have lived in at some point, if you've ever lived in a house. And think about how your house is situated ecologically. So I live in a house in a forest. That house sits on a hill. That hill is facing the south, so that the front of my house is facing southwards. We have a lot of beautiful windows in the front of our house, and it's one of the reasons we picked our house. And so all year round, we have beautiful sunlight coming in those southern exposure windows. And the way that our house is set up and the way that your house is set up means that there are certain kinds of things that will work in your particular house that won't work in other places. So for example, if I want plants to grow in my house, I am not going to put them in the northern windows of my house because it's dark there all the time. They will die if I put them in the northern windows. I put them in the southern windows and they flourish. If I was going to think about putting a chest freezer in my house somewhere, I would not put them in front of a southern window because there's light streaming through that glass pane all the time, and it would be difficult for that thing to stay cold because of where I placed it in my house. Our houses have a logic to them and a sense to them based on where they are in the universe. And that logic is called ecology. That's where the word ecology comes from. The logic of the house, the oikos. The logic of the house is ecology. And we have to learn to manage our house according to the rules and the logic of the house. And the way that we manage our house is that we set up some rules or laws of the house, the nomos of the house, the economy of the house, economy, the rules of the house. So we set up our economy, the way that we manage that house, in accordance with the ecology of the house, the logic of the house, in order to make it make sense. Now, I could, for example, I have had experience lately of having very small children in my house. And I could say to them, oh, look, here's a wonderful geranium that I'm going to give you. Where would you like to put it? And my second grader, when we first moved in there, might have said, oh, I want to stick it by my bed so that every morning when I wake up, I can see that geranium. And I would have thought, that's probably not a good idea. That geranium is only going to live for about 3 weeks by your bed because it's not going to have enough light to survive. If I asked the child to try to figure out where to put the appliances in the house, the child may very well want to put a chest freezer in front of the south window because it's easier to get to. We're all in the living room all the time. A child doesn't know the ecology of the house, so the child makes bad decisions economically about how to run the house because a child's mind isn't really thinking about the logic of the house. They're just thinking about what they want and what makes sense at the present moment. Now think about this. We live in a world house, don't we? The world is a house. It has its own rules and logic. And the question that faith traditions ask is, are we operating the ecology of, are we honoring the ecology of the world house with the economy that we're using to run it? Or is the economy we're using to run it acting like a bunch of toddlers fighting with each other, trying to figure out where to put their flowers because they like them in the right place without any sense of the rules that the house runs on or the logic that the house requires in order to make it sustainable? That's a good question. And so when we think about climate justice, I think we have to think about that bigger question of the relationship between economy and ecology. The same applies to the planet. We have great examples of this. Solar energy. If you think about the amazing, I was reading a book, okay, Rabbit Trail. So I'm taking this class on New England spirituality early this year. And so as part of it, I was reading the essays of Thoreau. And one of the essays of Thoreau about Paradise Regained, he talks about how we have plentiful resources of wind and sun and tides in order to, that could give us all the energy we ever needed to run our planet. Why don't we use it? Simply because we ignore the generosity of nature, he writes in 1845. Think about that. And still we haven't taken advantage of the generosity of the clean energy we have here for the planet. Solar energy, right? We get energy from the sun shining down on us. It's clean, it's free, no really bad side effects of it. It's a kind of a no-brainer that we would use it, right? So I opened up my email this week, and I was reading different articles that come into my box regularly, and I find this interesting article that says, take Florida for a case in point. Florida has the best solarity east of the Mississippi. Yet, it is 16th in the nation in terms of solar generation. That's odd, isn't it? It's behind New Jersey, behind Massachusetts, behind New York, and yet it's the Sunshine State. Attested to the fact that many of our people right now are in the Sunshine State ignoring warmer months down there. Florida residents spend 40% more than the national average per capita on energy. They're getting it from gas and coal, and gas, oil, and coal. And solar only makes up 1% of that state's energy mix. In Florida, key policies have spurred the solar revolution elsewhere are actually illegal. So as I was reading this article, I was just shocked to find out that state legislators in Florida have set no mandate to generate any portion of its electricity from renewable power, unlike many states in the United States that have done so. State law forbids anyone other than investor-owned utilities to buy or sell electricity. So landlords cannot sell power from solar panels to tenants, and solar leasing programs like those offered that we hear of sometimes by groups like Solar City or Sunrun are actually illegal in the state of Florida. No rooftop installations are allowed that charge for those installations. So really the only rooftop installations that are legal in Florida are ones that are put on by people who can afford the upfront costs of doing so. In fact, the state's Public Service Commission is pushing rate hikes and punishing fees for people who install solar on their houses. Does this make ecological sense? No, of course it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense at all when you think about the ecology of the house, and particularly of the state of Florida. So whose interest does it serve that these policies are in place? Well, I was looking through it, and it turns out that Florida's investor-owned utilities and powerful investors actually control the part-time Florida legislature. And they have done so since about 2007. $12 billion was spent on lobbying in the state of Florida just in 2007. And now there's one lobbyist for every two legislators in Tallahassee. Who funds that? The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and the Edison Institute, both of which are bankrolled by well-known oil and gas tycoons Charles and David Koch. In fact, Governor Rick Scott's 2014 re-election was financed by more than $1.1 million from IOUs and those big investors. In fact, shortly after his re-election, he filled an open slot on the Public Service Commission with Jimmy Patronis, the Florida State Chair of ALEC, which fights renewable energy and climate regulations. Shortly after that, the commission rubber-stamped Florida Power and Light's proposal to frack for natural gas in Oklahoma and pipe it into Florida. And in response to all this manipulation from big energy and big money, finally a citizens group arose, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and they mounted a $2 million campaign to qualify as a solar choice amendment for this year's election. And so this is what the article really was about, the power struggle about this year's election, getting this amendment on this year's election. And this amendment would have ended Florida's rate lock on electricity sales. It would have freed consumers to install leased solar panels on their homes or businesses, such as what we see sometimes around here. And owners of complexes would have been able to install arrays and divide the costs and benefits amongst the tenants of those complexes, like a mall or something like that. That sounds rational, doesn't it? 70% of Floridians agreed with that it sounds rational. But guess what happened? Some very, very powerful toddlers in the house started demanding that they wanted things done a certain way. And so big money and the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities, pulled a game plan from a very old playbook and the solar choice amendment that had been put up by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy was now going to be paired with another amendment on the ballot, and that amendment was going to be called, interestingly, Smart Solar. Doesn't this sound familiar? Kind of like right to work. So Smart Solar is an amendment which locked the existing statutes in place in the Constitution. In other words, Smart Solar said no changes to the status quo, and they managed to double the money that the Solar Choice campaign raised so they could launch many, many deceptive TV and radio advertising campaigns. We see these all the time in Ohio about the energy industry, right? People walking through fields with their backpacks, hiking in the wilderness, and you find out at the end it's supported by the coal industry or something, right? They've paid off all sorts of citizens groups to endorse that bill. 60 Plus is a senior group which received more than $15 million from the Koch donor network. Interestingly, they agreed to put $1 million into the campaign. The National Black Chamber of Commerce put $100,000 into the campaign. You wonder why? Well, they're funded by Exxon, Koch Industries, and Gulf Power. That's why. So they get big money from these industries, and then as an agreement, they do what the donors request in terms of policy endorsements. And every time the Solar Choice folks tries to raise the compensation rates for gatherers, when you gather signatures, they were saying, okay, let's raise it from $1 to $2 for the gatherers, when they saw all this force being pushed upon them by the big industries. The Smart Solar people would double the rates. So $2 per signature on the Solar Choice one will give $4 for a signature for Smart Solar. And they would send their gatherers out to gather signatures for their amendments. And finally, this just recently, last month, the Solar Choice organizers, realizing that they were going to be spent into submission, just gave up. And the amendment will not be on the ballot this fall. Odiously, after that defeat, Florida Power and Light went to the Public Service Commission with the former director of ALEC on it and asked for a 24% rate hike over the next 3 years because of the cost of funding their infrastructure. When we talk about climate justice, right, or green justice, we have to look at this problem holistically. You know, our kids are going to school and they're being taught wonderful things. Don't waste water, carry bags to the grocery store, and don't use the plastic bags, which can't be recycled. Reduce, reuse, recycle, that's all great. But is that the biggest problem? We have to ask, see, when you look at it holistically, is that the biggest problem? That's not really the biggest problem, is it? Not to say these things aren't good things. They are good things. But the problem, and the Pope points this out, is that we humans are trying to run the planet as if we were toddlers in a house we don't understand. Our Earth house is kind of being run without a brain, without a centralized brain, saying this goes here and that goes there, and this is the way it's going to work best. Instead, what we have is a bunch of people looking after their own interests, often fighting against each other to make those things work, with no realization of the needs of the house, the Earth house, and of the ecology of the planet. The people who are making decisions about how we manage our world, our economy, don't seem to be concerned at all with the logic of the house. They have no regard for the implications of their decisions for others or for the long-term health of the house itself. Wouldn't it be much better for the world and for consumers for them to be able to put solar panels on top of their houses in Florida? Of course it would. Everybody agrees with that. And this is immoral. And that is the message that the faith community must convey at this time. That is immoral. It is our unique contribution to this conversation because we deal with right and wrong. That's what faith communities do. And we need to stand up and say, if people care more for their own individual interests than for the interests of the whole house, this thing is going to collapse. The health of the whole world house matters more. It's a value judgment, and we have to make it, and we have to say it. We at this church love the earth. That was evidenced by our kids' time today and all of the things that we joined in with them in celebrating. But we also know that our planet is facing grave challenges because of the way we exist upon it. The planet, the animals, the plants, the oceans, the skies, and the humans upon it, we are all at risk because of the separation that exists today between the demands of the prevailing economy and the demands of our human and environmental ecology. So as we think about our love for the Earth, I'm going to invite you to do something today. We've got these little Valentines in your hands, I hope, and some little pieces of some pens to write with. I'm going to invite you to think about a Valentine's Day promise, something that would be good for the planet. It's Lent, and this is a time when we traditionally pause to reflect on our living, to remember the first things, to renew ourselves, and sometimes to make decisions. People often make decisions for Lent, and I encourage you to try out maybe something for 6 weeks. It may be something small. It may be something bigger. But go back to the sermon title, right? The Gift of Struggle. We're in a struggle. And the struggle is not just about how individually we live our lives. It's a struggle that this whole world is grappling with about whether or not we are going to run this planet based on the needs of its ecology or not. But there's a gift there. And the gift is, I think, one of those gifts is choice. We have choices. We are not without choice. And even in the midst of struggle, we have a choice to do something. It reminds us of our capacity. As a follow-up to our reading and discussion of Laudato Si last fall, we shared a bunch of ideas about things that we could do together. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Maybe that's something that you want to make a choice about. In your own home, have you done an energy audit? Maybe that's something you want to make a choice about. Are you using LED bulbs? Is your thermostat set to conserve energy at night? Do you take your bags to the grocery store? Maybe a choice about eating less meat or reducing waste or buying more local products so that the transportation system isn't polluting the atmosphere to get us our food. Maybe it's a choice about learning our own carbon footprints by going online and taking one of those carbon footprint calculator tests, such as the one offered by the Nature Conservancy. Maybe you could think about doing something this Lent that's out of the ordinary, like gathering a group of friends to have some snacks and watch a movie together, maybe one like Food Inc. or An Inconvenient Truth or Flow about water or Merchants of Doubt or Who Killed the Electric Car. These are all great things to do for Lent. Consider maybe making a switch to use greener energy sources at your own home or at your business or in your transportation choices. Maybe seeking out others who might be open to thinking about climate and environmental justice issues and deciding to talk about it with those folks. Maybe taking a step towards zero waste in your home or in your business. Or if you have a portfolio, to ask, am I funding obstructionist companies? And to ask your fund manager how you can get out of doing that if that is something that's hard for you to square morally with yourself. Donating to green energy causes. Maybe writing a letter to the editor, to your legislators about an issue that you're concerned about. Or maybe something as simple as voting or organizing for candidates that are committed to fighting systems which prioritize profit over justice for human beings and justice for the earth. Choosing to vote for people who can think holistically and understand the world and the individuals that are in it, who are part of it, as finite beings with limited resources that need to be honored for who they are, not for just their existence as resources for the use of others. So I invite you, while Jackie is playing some music in the background, to just reflect on a Valentine promise you'd be willing to make, a choice you'd be willing to make for this Lent, for the good of the whole house of the earth. And I invite you to write that down on the origami heart that you have there that the kids passed out. And I'm going to warn you that these are going to be integrated into our display up front. So don't write on there anything you don't want to be seen up front by people. And you can choose to sign it if you like, or you don't have to sign it if you feel like you'd rather not. That's fine. And if you happen to be done quickly, lean over to somebody next to you maybe and share what you wrote down with your neighbor in your pew. These are Valentine's Day wishes. Good gifts for the earth we love. Let's write those down.